What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined by podcast producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
Hey, everybody.
This week, it's kind of all about the thing we have been expecting for a while. The Department of Justice has confirmed that it really wants Google to sell Chrome. And this follows the news where they ruled that essentially that Google had a search monopoly. We've been talking about that for a better part of this year, actually. So that decision is down. We were all kind of expecting it. And also Android may be a part of this as well. We'll dive into all of it and also why none of this will probably ever happen. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We also do a live stream Thursday mornings around 10:45 a.m. Eastern. Join us. It's a fun time. I'm looking at folks right now in the chat. And yeah, you'll find, we have video on demand recordings of that stuff too. But come, sometimes we'll do Q&As. Sometimes we'll show off gadgets and things like that. Ben, we have been talking about this thing for a while, and I've been fishing around to like get some legal experts to join us at some point. But at this point, we can say the Department of Justice has officially said that it wants Google to sell off Chrome, and Google has responded in a way too. Google is saying this is a like staggering proposal that would harm consumers and affect U.S. Tech leadership, as Google would say.
Tech leadership, because you don't own your browser anymore. Sure.
Well, because it would be bad for America and it would be bad for the technology world if Google did not own Chrome. But to recap, folks, this goes all the way back to the ruling that Google was a search monopoly, and that came down to that Google was paying companies billions of dollars, including Apple. The report was like $20 billion in 1 year to make Google search the primary search on their operating systems. So that was, that was the thing the government could not really abide. But this was also the DOJ and also the FCC under the Biden administration, which was a lot stronger regulatory-wise. We've talked a lot about Lina Khan and what she's been doing at the FTC as well. And that stuff is just going to go away. It's going to evaporate like tears in the rain with the incoming Trump administration, which is pretty much there's a great piece by Carl Bode over at TechDirt that I think everybody should read. It's called Net Neutrality is Dead as a Doornail Under Trump 2.0. And that's pretty much it, because we've talked about the Biden administration sort of was making room. The rule that could have reenacted net neutrality was a thing that they restored this year, but it's been held up in court. So we never actually got proper net neutrality back in this country. And that's the idea that, ISPs, they're basically couldn't make up their own rules about how they manage their networks, about how they charged people. It was kind of a mess. Do you remember that whole conversation, Ben? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I absolutely remember it. And the thing that I'm thinking of right now is if you were on Reddit circa, I don't know, the late 2010s, or no, not late 2010s, excuse me, late aughts late through aughts, maybe yeah. The mid-2010s, every time people started talking about net neutrality, this photoshopped like flyer from one of the telecom companies, it's an imagined flyer from one of the telecom companies saying, here's your bundle. If you pay just $5 more, you get access to X and Y websites. Talking about data caps also. And that never came to fruition. So just to play the other side here, why is this different? Because it feels very much like the Looney Tunes situation of tearing down the posters. It's duck season. It's rabbit season. It's duck season. It's rabbit season. Net neutrality is dead or alive. Why is this different? Or is it different?
I just brought up the net neutrality thing in terms of regulation. But the big topic right now is regulation and what a future Trump administration would do when it comes to regulation of big technology companies, of companies in general, of the telecom industry. And in general, it seems like all signs point to regulation not being a thing anymore. I think even related to this, related to the, Google divesting of Chrome, Trump made a comment. He says, you could do without breaking it up is make sure it's more fair, end quote. I don't know what that means, but it fairness, according to...
That sounds like self-governance to me.
That sounds like the free market, just letting everything kind of land
hand
where they may. So that's kind of where we are right now. And just the idea of Google divesting of Chrome is something like we have brought up, and we've talked about the like mental model of that. And the only way that would have happened is if we existed in a country that was like very strong regulatory wise and had a lot of consumer protections. And basically, it seems like where we're headed is that consumer protections in general, all the good things we've been hearing about from the FTC just aren't really going to be a thing right now. The Tech Dirt article like had a really good list of things. Things like policing data caps. I think we brought that up at some point. Stopping companies from like ripping you off in many ways. The whole thing about if you subscribe to something easily online, you should be able to unsubscribe from it. All of those kinds of things are not going to be a big deal because at least from the conservative model, consumer protections just shouldn't exist. They just don't help anybody. So it sounds scary.
I think it's yet to be seen whether or not we're going to get to a world that the imagined telecom flyer that was often posted on Reddit was showing us, though.
I mean, probably. That was just a whole scary thing. So the DOJ's arguments for Google selling off Chrome is essentially like they want to open up the market a little bit and stop giving Google so much power when it comes to the control over the search industry in general and probably the advertising industry as well. But Google's comments on this are just so, let me see here. Google had like their lawyer, Ken Walker, president of global affairs and the chief legal officer, gave language that really sounds like he is speaking to Donald Trump. Like the incoming, hey, Mr. Donald Trump, here's from his letter. The DOJ had a chance to propose remedies related to this issue, in this case, search distribution agreements with wireless carriers. Instead, DOJ chose to push a radical interventionist agenda that would harm Americans and Americans' global technology leadership. DOJ's wildly overbroad proposal goes miles beyond the court's decision. It would break a range of Google products, even beyond search, that people love and find helpful in their everyday lives. Because we love our Google, guys. Everybody loves Google. Nobody's pissed off about Google search getting progressively worse, being hard to find, you know, finding things, or how shitty Gemini is in general. There's a bunch of bullet points. It would endanger the security and privacy of Americans. One that I found really interesting, it would chill our investment in artificial intelligence. Think about Google's investment in artificial intelligence, everybody.
Google's investment in putting artificial intelligence first on their Google searches when it isn't actually all that useful.
Think of the tens of billions of dollars that Google has spent on artificial intelligence. Won't you think of that? They're saying it's perhaps the most important innovation of our time, where Google plays a leading role. Don't quite believe that. They also bring up this thing that we talked about.
Wait. Yeah. I just saw another thing that said, hurt innovative services like Mozilla Firefox, businesses depend on Google. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to bring that up because we have talked about this. We've talked about the idea that it is wild that a large chunk of Mozilla's revenue, the nonprofit Mozilla, comes from it, charging
and when
Google.
We talk about a large chunk, we're talking about like
90%.
80%? Yeah, like a ridiculous amount.
So basically, Mozilla as an organization depends on it charging Google for this stuff. And now Google can turn around and be like, hey, you're going to hurt Mozilla if we can't charge Google for search placement. So, yeah, that's kind of the world we live in right here. And I totally see like Google's response, and I see like the tech industry at large. Like, certainly the libertarians are like not super cool with the idea. Don't worry, guys. It's never going to happen. It really won't happen. Not in the upcoming administration when it comes to regulation. But also, everything that we're seeing, the Trump folks aren't even in office yet. But from their plans, it does seem like the Supreme Court is already stacked in their favor. Federal appointees are going to be there for a long time, too, coming as part of this administration. It's going to be years, probably decades, before we can like really wade through all this stuff and like, I don't know, bring actual like regulation that could help consumers back. So that's kind of a dark time we're entering, Ben. I don't know how you feel about this. It's not good.
I really don't like to think that it would be decades, but
it would be a while unless the opposition to conservatives, unless Democrats started really being strong about how they used power and wielded power and pushed regulation in general. But there are things you can't stop, right? If the Supreme Court, which is already like conservative packed, right? Unless you expand that court or do other things to kind of give future Democratic leadership more ability to regulate these companies. We're just going to have them run free reign. And that's really worked well over the past few decades, folks.
I do think that like seeing how lawless this new administration is posed to be, that there could be an increased appetite for, you know, very sweeping changes like packing the court. But that is literally just me being optimistic, perhaps. So in this like list of bullets of talking about why this is like why selling Chrome is bad for Google, it's pretty predictable. It's saying, look, it's going to hurt us. We can't possibly do this. And the moon in the chat says literally every company would say that. And it's true. Literally every company has said this all the way back to the trust-busting movement of the 20th century, all the way back to the labor movement also in the 20th century. We can't have an eight-hour workday. All of the businesses would go under then.
We can't have weekends. We can't have children not work in our factories. Think of the production of the American economy.
Their tiny little hands are so good at getting into the machines as they're running.
This is America. Like, this is in general the history of America and the history of capitalism in general, right? Like, fighting against any rules to constrain things. So, yeah.
Okay, but let's talk about the gadget angle of this. So let's say Chrome is sold off. Does that mean Chromebooks? Let's say that Android is also spun off.
The Android thing, by the way, is very particular. The Android thing is if Google cannot stop doing the thing where they're basically making Android, where they're making people pay them to make Google the default in Android phones. If they don't cut that out, they're going to the government's like, well, you should also sell off Android. So that's more
so
of
that's
like an
like
even
a
more
stick
hypothetical
stipulation.
Thing. Yes.
It's like, if you don't do this, then we're also going to come for your mobile division.
Which I think that would be a far bigger deal. Like, Android is the thing. Android is sort of, it's like the Windows of the smartphone world, right? It is the thing that powers a multitude of devices from other companies. Google absolutely took the Windows PC model there to do that. That would be earth-shattering for Google. Chrome is just like, well, it's a browser a lot of us use. It's a very popular browser. I also could easily see how like, you could just like carve that off and let that go off and be its own thing. And I think that could actually end up being better for Chrome, because the problem with Chrome right now is that it is so bogged down with Google garbage.
How does Chrome make money then?
That's a good question. I'm not a business person. There could potentially be deals or other things Chrome could do. I am not sure how browsers make money in general, but that's up to these companies to figure out. The way Google does it right now is Chrome pays for itself because it leads people back to Google products. It leads people back to Google search. It serves people Google ads. So,
because how long has it been since we had a dedicated company that does a browser and just a browser? Forget the fact that Mozilla is pretty much a like vassal state to Google. We're talking about Opera. Talking about...
which charges people a minimal fee, I believe, for browsers. So that was the whole thing, yeah.
Okay, and how much market share does it have?
Not much. But that's the thing. The whole reason, a big part of what the DOJ has been saying too is like Google is so powerful. It has also made Chrome so powerful because it owns searches and could put all its funding into this browser, which is free, sure, but which sort of dominates the landscape in a way that is uncompetitive. And, you know, it's a hard argument to make too. It's like the thing with Microsoft in the 90s. That was the antitrust hearing there was about including Internet Explorer within Windows. And that was in an era where Netscape was like, hey, we have to charge people $30. I think I remember spending $30 for Netscape at some point when I was a teenager to get that thing. And Netscape was like, that's anti-competitive because Microsoft can just dump their thing in here for free. Google can just dump in Chrome for free or make it available, make it a core part of the Android experience, right? And that just spreads its footprint and doesn't really give people options. It's the thing. Like, options exist, but it's hard for them to survive because you're right, Ben. How does a browser make money?
I don't think we've seen that in the modern era. So I don't know if we had a like definitive answer. Do you think this would include Chromebooks if we're looking at the gadget angle?
Yeah. Yeah. Those are Chrome powered.
How Chrome makes money then. Chrome the browser sells maybe like they
nobody's
make
buying.
Some I mean, big yeah. push into becoming more of a consumer technology company.
That's hard. No,
that's innovation.
Like, if this happened, no.
I'm sorry. Go and innovate then.
Chromebooks are dead. Like if this actually happened, Chromebooks are probably dead because hardware requires a lot more expertise. Like if they're carving this off and they're just going to be okay, your Chrome is its own separate thing. The hardware people are at Google. You know, so the people who make the Chromebooks and design the Chromebooks are at Google. The people who design the software may be on the Chrome side. I actually don't know how that works up. But either way, you would not want to sell those things because the market for selling laptops right now is kind of tough. Even big companies like Apple and Dell like have trouble at times doing this stuff, like building the hardware, getting it out there, doing consumer support and things like that.
Well, and then there's a question of, okay, does Chrome spin out on its own and become Chrome Inc., or does it potentially get sold to something else? Is it a possibility that, I don't know, a bunch of other tech companies could form some kind of consortium to buy Chrome and, I don't know, fight over it via, like, that financial instrument or something?
That may be another way, too. That may, like, Google cuts off a limb, right, and the others start fighting over it. I was thinking, like, you don't want, like, Microsoft to just go and buy this, right? You want to have some, like, stipulations against that, too. And Microsoft is also very wary about any more, like, antitrust stuff. So these are open questions. I would love to see it. I would love to, like, know how a company like that could survive. But also, this stuff, like the breaking up of AT&T, Ma Bell into, like, Baby Bells, was that in the 80s? That definitely helped to spread, it helped lower prices, it increased competition, like it made it easier for people to get long distance service, I believe, and just phone service in general. There, when we talked about that, there were arguments that may have held back innovation a little bit, like the ability to make phone lines faster for internet was maybe slowed down a little bit because it wasn't like a giant AT&T anymore. But at the end of the day, like we survived, and I think overall people had more options. And if you hear like one thing from our podcast and that we keep talking about, competition always makes this stuff better, right? It helps Apple to have Google in the Android side of things, doing what they're doing with Android to push what iPhone could be doing or what their products could be doing. It helped when we had other competing platforms too, like Windows Phone, the sort of like glorious moment when we had Windows Phone and Android and iPhone, and everyone was just like trying to figure out the mobile web. It was so cool and so exciting, and people were taking features from each other. That made these products better. That's evolution, right?
Yeah, but I also can't help but think that this is like a halfway measure, and what actually should be broken up is Google's ad business.
That's because that is Google. Yeah.
When you break up Ma Bell, you're breaking up, yes, like a whole telecom monopoly. The actual monopoly that exists on the internet is, okay, maybe there are two. One is how you access the internet, and Chrome has an enormous market share there. But two, I frequently talk about that figure I saw where something like $3 out of every $4 in online advertising is spent at either Google or Facebook.
Yep.
So the real thing that you need to break up there, especially if you want like just a better ecosystem of advertising to support other ventures online, other smaller websites, maybe break up the big advertisers online. But that would be really, really hard.
Well, now you're sounding like a straight up socialist, Ben. Like the most impressive thing to do. I think that would be the ideal thing to do. I think Chrome was the easy target to be like, hey, it's just the browser, right? It is just Google's browser. Google's real business is advertising. So we have found that, yes, Google search, definitely a monopoly. Maybe we could help to like stave off that influence a little bit if we at least push Google to sell off Chrome and also stop these deals where Google can make itself the default on all these other platforms. So I think it was like a low-hanging fruit thing, you know?
Yeah, that they could exactly. Do. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So it's funny that people are reacting like, oh my God, could you believe Google could do that? Probably. I mean, potentially. And that probably would have helped things too. But we will never know. We will probably never know what it would be like if Google had to sell off Chrome, because it's just going to be just all big tech going forward, guys. It's all. Did you see the news, Ben, that I think when Google CEO called the Trump administration to say congrats, right? Elon Musk was on the line.
Oh, I didn't see the thing about Elon. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the story I saw. But that is also where we are. Never forget about Elon Musk being such a crucial part of this like administration, at least right now. But he poured $200 million dollars into it. He is there at Trump's ear. And you've got big tech literally just controlling the reins of government and regulation soon. So,
and the funny thing is that the folks who are running these companies, like Musk and like Thiel, don't see themselves as big tech. They see themselves as maybe in the middle layer because they're not Amazon. They're not Google or maybe Facebook or something. And they're like, oh, well, I'm just a scrappy little business founder.
I don't know about that. No. Like Elon Musk sees himself as the future of humanity. His children will take
over. Oh, he sees himself as the future of humanity. But the reason that he has such a victim complex is because he's not Jeff Bezos.
He's still richer than Jeff Bezos, so he still wins.
On paper. And I think that that's what bothers him. That it's all, like, it's not all paper wealth, but it is significantly more paper wealth for Musk than it is for Bezos.
I don't know.
How they measure themselves.
Yeah, I mean, they're all kind of like dick measuring at this point. But there's also the thing where I think there's a good argument that socially, the culture started to turn against Elon Musk when he started leaning more into right-wing politics, being more of a meme lord online. I think the turning point for a lot of people was the whole the kids being trapped in a cave thing, where he just lost his mind online and started calling, like, the dude who was actually trying to help a pedophile and just, like...
Yep. He's like, why are you even in Thailand? Yeah, like, only weirdos go to Thailand.
That's pretty much it. And a dude bought Twitter to be king tweeter, you know, so everybody likes his stuff and gets mad when Biden got more likes or engagement in a post than he did. So that's kind of where we're at.
There is some significant evidence that he thought that the woke mind virus turned his daughter trans, and he wanted to buy the place where the woke mind virus lived.
It's the war on woke, folks. Anyway, drop us an email at podcastinggadget.com. Let us know what you think about this, this thing that will never actually happen. But the idea of government regulation of overpowered technology companies, what a concept. All right, let's move on to some other news and also kind of related to corporate readjustments. Comcast announced that it is spinning out Rotten Tomatoes and the cable networks it owns into a separate company. And those cable networks include USA Network, remember them? CNBC, MSNBC, Oxygen, E! Sci-Fi, Golf Channel. They're all going to have a new home in a spinoff company, which does not have a name yet. That's kind of interesting. Comcast is hanging on to NBC Universal stuff. So that is NBC proper, which is a broadcast network, Peacock, the streaming service, film and TV studios, Telemundo and theme parks, and Bravo.
It seems like it's holding on to everything that makes them a lot of money and letting go of everything that makes them only a little money or
cable's
break even.
Cable's a tough thing to hold right now. I don't know what you do with Rotten Tomatoes at this point, too, which was such a cool, useful service when it launched and has now just become an arm of the TV, of the like movie industry, right? Like Rotten Tomatoes, they also owned Fandango. Fandango is going to be a part of the spinoff company. It is really wild to think that the company where a lot of people buy tickets from is also owning the same thing that owns Review Aggregator that tells people which movies to go see. That was a weird thing. That was a weird thing when it happened.
It's
vertical integration. I know people who worked at Rotten Tomatoes. I know they tried hard to like keep some editorial separation there, but it's tough. Like when you're just owned by a company that just wants people to go to the movies or, you know, make money off of that investment. So kind of an interesting thing. I wonder what they'll do with the spinoff company and what's even going to be called.
This spinoff company has the potential to have a profoundly stupid name. If we know anything from the Quibbies of the world.
The Quibbies, the Go 90s of the world, they're all terrible, folks. I mean, listen, I'm also a big fan of Mubi, which is the subscription service that also brought some cool movies to theaters, like The Fall. They brought back The Fall and The Substance. But there's also a free version that they do called Tubi. So it's just really hard to keep all these things in track, but... we'll be following this too. I saw the story about, this is kind of how we framed it. Sony's reportedly in talks to buy the Elden Ring and Dark Souls developer because essentially they're in talks to acquire Kadokawa, which is a Japanese publisher. They own a majority stake, like 70% stake in From Software, creators of the Souls games. But they also own a bunch of things. They own the Anime News Network. They own other developers too, like, was it Acquire, I believe? Yeah, Acquire is the company that made Tenchu and a bunch of other games. There's a whole bunch of anime properties and other things as part of this too. So the story here is less about Elden Ring, I'd say. I think that would be a nice get for Sony. It's more about, like, this is Sony potentially doing like a Marvel deal. Like when Disney bought Marvel, like there's all this stuff underneath this brand that this brand owns that could be really useful for them. Sony's been investing more in anime too, so it all kind of makes sense, right?
I have a feeling that people are going to be very mad about this, and I hope that it doesn't get bogged down in like corporate bureaucracy, because I think that's what the fear is.
I mean, who knows? Who knows what this is going to do? Don't forget also Sony owns Funimation. Is part of Sony now, which is a big anime studio, and they bought Crunchyroll. Oh, wow. They bought Crunchyroll from AT&T, speaking of AT&T again, in 2021. So,
wait, so Sony owns Crunchyroll? I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. Yep. Sony officially bought them. I don't know. There has not been any update beyond that. But yeah, they bought Crunchyroll for $1.2 billion towards the beginning of the pandemic. This is more about anime than it is about Elden Ring, I would say. Did you see the story, Ben, about undersea internet cables, data cables being cut in the Baltic Sea?
Yes. Yeah. Mm. And
what's happening there.
Yes. I wonder what major power city is on the Baltic Sea. Could it be St. Petersburg? Where is St. Petersburg? So, yeah, there's a non-zero chance that this could be Russian meddling. But I also want to leave it up to, you know, leave a little chance for there to be that it was just some other concern that was annoyed about, that they didn't get to lay these undersea cables. Maybe it was like an actual corporate actor or something. I am not defending Russia here. I am not defending Russia here, but sometimes silly little things like that happen. And people are like, wait, it isn't an international incident? That's so confusing.
It would be that some good, like, 4D chess, 5D chess, right? Where you're like, yes, the risk, everybody's looking at Russia now. So if we do a thing and blame them, probably easy to make it a whole thing. That is the entire plot of The Diplomat on Netflix. So yes, that is definitely a good, like,
subterfuge upon subterfuge.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, just point to an easy villain. Let me see here. So yeah, so the story is Germany says these undersea cut, the cables were definitely sabotaged. It wasn't some sort of error. And another cable connecting Lithuania and Sweden was also cut on Sunday. The timing here, especially when you're looking at Russia's war against Ukraine and kind of the news that the U.S. would be allowing for more powerful missiles to be used, like sending more missiles to Ukraine, like it all seems like a response to that whole thing. Maybe a response to delay any other sort of action until the Trump administration comes in, and all of a sudden that whole war is over, right? Like Ukraine's just gone, unfortunately.
I don't know about that. Yeah. Like, we would really have to see, because on one hand, like, yes, a Trump administration would really like to roll over and show its belly like a dog to Putin. But on the other hand, there's a lot of nationalist fervor coming in there, especially if Hegseth ends up actually as the Secretary of Defense. And so there might be some people who are like, actually, nationalism is good. And Ukraine has a lot of nationalism right now. They are fighting for their country. So
yeah. I don't know. I don't know, Ben. First of all, we don't know if any of those nominations, that guy, the recent story about his background is, I don't think that's going to fly. But also Tulsi Gabbard, who was nominated to lead U.S. intelligence. Oh, good God. Tulsi Gabbard. I have so many feelings about Indian Americans who go into politics and always just show their asses. Very much, she's a Russian asset, basically. So
It feels like the headline is Wolf wearing silly little costume of a sheep nominated to be the
head of sheep security. So, you know, that again, another nomination I don't think will actually go through, but who knows what this Congress will do now. To me, that is the worrying thing. Like, we know Trump's alliances, and we kind of know that more and more people are very Russia-pilled within his, like,
Russia-pilled.
Yeah. Because they're getting, it doesn't matter. It's not about country, man. Like, they are getting money from these people. And that's kind of just the way, that's what's going to lead them. That's what's going to lead this entire administration. It's going to be scary to see, folks.
So the moon in the chat says, Trump's appointments are just memes to gaslight the progressives and keep everyone distracted.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That would be a great idea if we haven't already seen that this administration does not think about step 1.5. It is all id.
You are putting more thought into it if you're thinking it's a meme just to make fun of progressives. Yeah. Like, you are putting more thought into it than I think this administration is, where literally it's just who are my friends? Who are my loyal supporters? Like, that is the fascist, playbook, is essentially you want loyalty rather than expertise in among the people in charge around you, and he is picking the loyalist people around him. So there are insane choices. Frickin' the co-founder of the WWE, the head of education,
Linda McMahon.
We are full on Idiocracy, folks. Full on Idiocracy.
Yeah,
so,
seriously.
I don't think it's just trolling. Like, these are legit things. They may not ever actually come to pass, but these are the legitimate things that they are trying to do. And I have to say, every time somebody's like, "Oh yeah, they're just joking," yada yada yada, I don't know. That still ended up with a lot of people being hurt. It ended up with being families being separated at the border. It ended up with kids in immigration camps at the border. The stupidity still leads to, like, really, really painful outcomes for people, even if you think it's a joke. So
The only thing that I have to, like, only advice that I have for listeners going into this new era is, don't pay so much attention to the palace intrigue of the next 4 years, especially all of the MSNBC, like, mm-hmm. Oh, I hope, you know, everyone in the White House has a headache and diarrhea, and, like, because there is a lot of, like, I just wish these people are having a bad day. Look beyond that and just look at the vector of where policy is going. Cast your mind in that direction rather than spending so much time watching the, like, tiny little details dribble out of an administration where everyone hates each other and they come from a culture where cooperation is not valued.
It's going to be, I don't know, it's going to be a thing to watch. I know you wanted to talk about this, Ben, the whole Pokemon Go thing, or the Niantic essentially saying that they used the data from Pokemon Go and their other games to create a large geospatial AI-powered model of the world.
Yes, this is spooky, but not surprising. Let's remember the fact that Niantic...
It was part of Google for a while, too, wasn't it?
It was part of Google for a while. So it was founded by John Hankey and in 2001, and it got money from the CIA's venture capital fund. Mm-hmm. So if he wasn't an intelligence guy before, he went into this with intelligence aspirations. It was purchased by Google in 2004. The original Niantic, or the original name for Niantic, was Keyhole Inc. And then from 2004 to about 2015, it was part of Google and it focused on games, and then it spun out as Niantic in 2015. Pokemon Go Summer was 2016. While it was at Google, let's be really, really cognizant mm-hmm. of what was happening at Google at that time. They wanted to turn users into a Mechanical Turk.
Right.
Think about how they were also, very enthused with Luis Van Aan and all of his work that he did with ReCAPTCHA, because they were trying to digitize all the books, and ReCAPTCHA was really instrumental in getting humans to figure out a word that their optical software couldn't figure out. So this is very much like they're taking a lot of information from the Google playbook and saying, okay, well, what if we just had the users do work for us? Von Ahn's later company, Duolingo, runs on that same idea. I was a, like, very part-time producer for a show called The Genius Dialogues, I think, that came out through Audible. And these were, you know, a bunch of people who had won MacArthur Genius Grants. One of the interviews was Luis Van Aan, and he's like, yeah, that's actually one of the big things that I brought to Google and brought to computer science, period. I wanted to use users, you know, 5 minutes a day or so to be a better computer than the computers that they had at the time. So it makes so much sense that Niantic is now using all of the information that it gathered via Pokemon Go, via the Harry Potter, like Pokemon Go similar game. And now they also have this Pikmin game where people are just walking around, you know, creating maps. And now all phones have LiDAR. Wow. Wow. So, yes, they are doing this large geospatial model similar to an LLM. And I think the thought among a lot of people is that this is going to power, you know, maybe the Boston Dynamics robo dogs of the future or something.
Well,
much easier for them to navigate in like large spaces.
I mean, this is, yeah, again, they've been doing this from the start too. Like, so I'm not too surprised about this model because forever Niantic has been talking about like, we just want to gather a lot of location data. And that's been through the lens of Pokemon Go and a lot of the games they've said. I wrote up something that they did. Let me see here. Campfire. They had like something called Campfire, which was a social app they wanted to make as sort of like a Discord alternative. They were trying to get people to like think more about the stuff that they're doing locally. But yeah, it just kind of fully makes sense. In 2022, they announced this thing called Lightship VPS, or Virtual Positioning System. It was a new platform that let developers accurately learn the position and orientation of users with centimeter-level precision. So this is an idea. They've been gathering this data for a while. The idea of turning it into like an AI model, I guess, is sort of new, but this is the thing. They've wanted to sell this data to do more accurate stuff around location-based tasks in general. Like if, I don't know if you've ever used Google Maps when you're walking around, Ben, but the thing like where you actually get turn-by-turn directions. So one thing that Niantic mentioned in their blog post around this news is that essentially they're thinking of like AR glasses too, where you're wearing AR glasses and you get like really, really granular directions and instructions. And this model could help to, you know, power some of that stuff. It's an entirely evil thing. I think it'll help a lot of people because it's really, I remember life driving before GPS was a nightmare. Being able to like walk accurately if you're wearing smart goggles could be useful. But yeah, it's, I could see why people could be freaked out about this. How are you feeling about the idea of this thing?
So Ruindig in the chat says, let's not forget that Niantic founder and CEO John Hanke was also on the Google Geo team. So yeah.
I'm sure Google has been thinking of this.
Around the time when Keyhole was acquired, this was when Google was really trying to build up Google Maps. And so this makes so much sense. He's just a maps guy. What I have to say about this is that if there is a new Niantic game that wants you to scan the interior of your house or apartment or office building, absolutely don't download it.
You're doing it already, Ben. You're doing it already when you're looking for Pokemon in your house, right? They don't have to ask you to just go around scanning. They could just, hey, here's a thing you want to collect. Take out your LiDAR, your personal LiDAR, and give us that data, you know?
What you give us is very granular information on how to allow a Boston Dynamics robot to kick in your door, and you get Pikmin.
You get Pikmin. Another thing they brought up is that it'll teach the models things about things they haven't seen. Sort of like if there's enough, if you're like behind a church and it doesn't have like accurate data around that specific church, it can interpolate what the back part of a church would be like based on the data of collected thousands of their other churches they've seen. So they could like interpolate what the architecture could be or something like that. So it's a way this stuff could fill in the gap for information they don't have either. That is kind of interesting, but Yeah, I don't know what this is going to lead to. I don't know if smart glasses will be a thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So Declan in the chat is saying, I wonder if Amazon is doing the same thing with that see in your room option on their app. So, you know, if you wanted to use augmented reality to see how like a couch would fit in your room, but what you're actually also doing is exactly what they want you to do.
You're showing them the layout of your room. And the problem before was they have all this data. It's really hard to do anything with it if you just have a ton of data. But with AI models, there is more of a chance where you could use an LLM to kind of train the idea of what do living rooms look like now? What kind of devices would fit ideally in a living room today? That sort of thing you could train an LLM to eventually do. And I don't know. It's inescapable unless you just don't use those tools at all. You know, anything that involves your camera, especially the 3D mapping of your space, that stuff is potentially dangerous if you're worried. Yeah.
One, LGM, not LLM, because geospatial.
Yes, yes,
and
yes,
two,
yes.
Let's connect this with the idea of
any large model. Yeah.
What was it? A year ago or maybe a couple years ago when Roomba, they were talking about, you know, maybe it was mapping the inside of your house. Because just by like running into all of the corners and the walls in the room, it is developing
a map.
The general sense of, yes, a map of your room and everything. Man-made horrors beyond our comprehension coming soon.
If they have the data, they will try to sell it. And I think in general, we can see these companies want to collect the data. The question is, what do they do with it? You know, and that is more of what I'm worried about. And if you're worried about this stuff, then just be careful about these types of devices that you use. Yeah.
Yeah. So bringing it down to much more petty news, the Bitfinex hacker launderer Heather Razzlecon Morgan was sentenced to 18 months in prison.
Just you got to live to see it. You got to live to see it because these people have annoyed me for so long. But yeah.
In 2016, her husband hacked Bitfinex. She helped launder 120,000 Bitcoin, which was worth a lot then and is worth a lot more now. But still, I think we were talking about millions of dollars even back in 2016. And then what did they do with it? They did the most gaudy windfall new money shit you could imagine.
Yeah.
The Razzlecon moniker. If you don't know about it, you will know sometime soon because Netflix is coming out with a documentary about this whole Bitcoin heist. And she shot a music video. She's looking very Burning Man these big glasses and like cheetah print jacket. I think she was shooting it down in Lower Manhattan, like in front of the stock exchange, talking about, she said that she was like the Bitcoin crocodile or something in this rap that was terrible. It was bad, everybody.
Yeah, I remember. It was so dumb. And that was certainly the peak of like, I just hate all the crypto people. I think that was the point where I was like, man, it would have been very smart to mine one Bitcoin in 2009 when all this stuff, or 2010, when it was all very, very early. But now it's just like, oh, these are the worst people, which is, it sucks because some people did make a lot of money. Like this stuff did materially.
I know someone who paid for the down payment on their house in crypto. They didn't transfer crypto to the bank, but they had crypto. They sold it for USD and they paid for their apartment or their condo in Boston.
That is, I guess, the dream. But also like, that was before we knew more about the material costs of crypto and kind of, I think especially the environmental costs. Like that was something that people did not fully understand early on. And I think that became more and more gross as this whole thing, like any gold rush, any like, you know, new money rush to power and money, like it is gross to see. There is a Netflix documentary coming out, and I tried watching the trailer for that thing, Ben, and good God, I don't think that's going to be any good. Netflix makes a lot of bad documentaries.
Yes, they're very sensational. I think they've learned, Netflix in general has learned a lot from like 48 Hours Mysteries and not quite enough from Ezra Edelman.
Netflix, well, it's more like the people who make documentaries for Netflix know that they could do kind of a subpar job. They could just make like a shitty thing. And
because they're making stuff for like USA Network.
Yeah, it'll get a decent amount of views on Netflix, and then like you don't have to really put as much effort as like the Errol Morrises of the world used to, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and Ezra Edelman actually does have a Netflix documentary about Prince, an enormous thing that is now held up by Prince's estate. Go look up some articles
really
about
that
because that was so much fun to read.
Yeah.
I want to see that so badly, and he might be fully gray by the time that comes out, if it comes out.
That's a shame. And that also goes down to like Prince's estate and Prince's whole thing around his own image and everything. Like, that was just who he was. That's even less of a Netflix problem, you know, but man, would love to see that eventually.
Yeah, so one last word on Razzle Khan. The prosecution noted, I'm reading from a CoinDesk article now, the prosecution noted how deeply involved she was in seeking to conceal and use the millions her husband stole, sharing examples of her subterfuge, including personally burying gold coins acquired with the cryptocurrency. She was the one that dug the hole, a lawyer from the prosecution said. She jumped into the conspiracy. And all she has to say for herself is a video tweeted on X where she's looking very much like Heather and very much not like Razzle Khan in pearl necklace and everything, saying, guys, I'm so sorry.
So sorry. I did not want to hear about these people again, but okay. Kind of good to hear like there's something, some sort of punishment for this thing.
There's going to be a lot of people that don't get comeuppance in the next few years. So let's take a second to appreciate when that does happen.
What do you mean, Ben? I think the justice system and our entire system is working perfectly. Let's move on to what we're working on. I just want to shout out, I wrote up a review, write up about Dragon Age The Veil Guard. I've put about 20 hours into that game so far. Good game. Good Dragon Age. Also good time to be like building a ragtag group of people fighting extreme evil against all odds and seeming doom. So, you know, that kind of works out really well. Do you play Dragon Age at all, Ben?
No, I actually can't remember the last BioWare game I played. It
really?
Might have been Mass Effect.
Mm-hmm.
It was Mass Effect 3.
Mass Effect 3. Oh, that was a while ago. What is that? Is that a decade now?
If it wasn't a decade, it was, you know, like eight
it
or so.
It feels like 20 years ago at this point. But anyway.
Okay, so tell me, why should I be playing Dragon Age? Why should I be getting back into
BioWare? It's good stuff. Like, it's pretty much a really fun, they've turned it more into like an action RPG almost. Like, the combat now is very much like the newer God of War, which itself is lifted a little bit from the Souls games. So there's more like direct combat. You could still have your friends kind of issue spells and whatnot, but it feels good. It looks incredible. As I said in my review, like, this is some of the best ray tracing I've ever seen. So, you know, sometimes you just want spectacle. Sometimes you just want like realistic lighting of magical effects being deployed across huge environments. Like, it looks good. It feels good. And you get the wonderful like companion stuff too, like just hanging out with people. It feels good. And this game has been in development for 10 years. It's been rebooted several times. Yeah, so I'm surprised. Like, it's been 10 years since Dragon Age Inquisition. This directly follows the story of Inquisition and the DLC of that. There were some major revelations that came out from the DLC in that game. So I'm digging it. I'm not like the biggest Dragon Age fan, but for what I'm doing, like for where I am right now, it was really nice to spend a couple hours just in a fantasy world doing fun RPG things. And yeah, BioWare still got it. I hope some of this translates to whatever new Mass Effect thing they're doing, because I loved Mass Effect, the trilogy, then Andromeda happened, and I don't know what the hell happened there.
I mean, Andromeda was Mass Effect, the quest for more money, and I think that's what sunk the entire series. Because in so many cases, like with Halo, they want to eventually come out with a Halo or Mass Effect, you know, 2K24, mm-hmm. 2K25, so they can keep this going. But I think what a lot of the like business people in these game companies don't really understand is that the brands actually appreciate in value, sort of like wine. So imagine there was a 5-6 year or longer time between, you know, the end of the Mass Effect trilogy and the next Mass Effect game, I think people would be like, wow, I'm so looking forward to being back in this world.
Yeah, sort of like being oversaturated with Star Wars or even the Marvel stuff. Like, you got to miss it a little bit to really want it again. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Kevin says in the chat that these games are basically big budget movies now. Yeah, sure. But I think that big budget movie IP also appreciates if you aren't having, you know, a new Mission Impossible movie every 2 years. We saw that for Marvel, especially, and we were literally just talking about that.
So anyway, good game. Good Dragon Age. I think you'd like it, Ben. It's a good entry point into the series, but you should probably go watch some lore videos so you can know what the hell is happening in the world of Dragon Age.
I do like lore videos.
It's a good bit of lore stuff there, too. And something I want to shout out, I'm not quite working on it, but I am. I just picked up a new receiver for my home theater system. And after I reviewed the PlayStation 5 Pro, I realized, like, I have basically one from 10 years ago that can do 4K, but it can't do the newer stuff. It can't do 4K 120 FPS. It can't do, I don't care about 8K, but if I ever test 8K devices, I'm like not in a situation to deal with that. And this has some of Sony's new immersive surround sound technology too. I wanted to play around with some of that stuff. So I've picked up Sony's STR-AN1000 receiver, which came out, I think, last year. It's been heavily discounted. They likely have a new thing coming during CES. But I just want to say, like, what an upgrade this was for my home theater. Because I had a really nice Harman Kardon receiver before. But I don't know if it's the calibration or what. But this thing is, like, pumping my speakers and my subwoofer harder in a way that feels more cinematic. And it just could be Sony's processing. It's sort of like that way with TVs too. Like, Sony will often use the same panels that LG uses on their OLEDs, but Sony's image processing does more work and some people tend to prefer it. So at least on this receiver, I can really feel the difference with Sony's audio technology at this point. And my walls are shaking. So my wife loves that.
And you're happy about that, right?
I love to have my walls shake. And yeah, it's a good thing. Good receiver, and we're prepping for CES, so I wonder if this means like they have something else cooking for CES time. One of my favorite bits of CES, I'll be going actually for the first time since before the pandemic.
Wow.
Is seeing the stuff, seeing the TVs, hearing the speakers, and it's rare to actually be surrounded by that stuff and to like relate to you all what it actually looks and feels and sounds like. So it'll be interesting to see what Sony and Samsung and everybody has cooking there. All right, let's move on to our pop culture picks. What do you got, Ben?
I am so McGee-pilled, Devendra. Mm-hmm. Do you know about this?
Which, like, McGee?
Musician. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is...
American McGee?
No, this is M, and it's definitely not McGee, the, Mick G.
Yes.
The director.
Not the McGee. Yeah.
No, this is MK.GEE, a musician. First saw things about this guy on TikTok, and I am very suspicious of anything that I see first on TikTok.
Agreed.
Because I'm also, like, I'm not sure if it's, you know, a big record concern that's trying to push this to me, or if this is someone who had, you know, a popular song in, you know, a teen movie on Netflix or something. And that's not the sort of thing that I would like. I just saw, okay, here's a guy. It seems to be like very vocal forward. It sounds a little bit like an 80s heartthrob magazine. And I'm like, I'm not sure if I would, like this. But then I started seeing him everywhere. I follow Hayley Williams on Instagram, and, you know, she's posting Instagram stories about, like, oh, I just got back from tour. You know, Paramore was opening for Taylor Swift on the Europe Eras tour dates. And she was like, oh, I'm so sad that I didn't get to see McGee in Nashville. You know, I'm finally back home now. I'm like, okay, that's a cosign from someone that I respect. Then I see a headline just a few days later. Eric Clapton is like, oh yeah, this new musician, MK.GEE, I'm messing with him. I really like him. And I'm like, all right, that's definitely something to pay attention to. And so I listened to his not debut album. I think this is his second album, Two Star and the Dream Police. And oh my God, if you like Genesis, if you like The Police, people are comparing this guy a little bit to Prince.
What's old is new again, as always.
What? Yeah. Yes, what's old is new again. I'm surprised that it took this long for like the 80s style of production to come all the way back around.
This guy was, I'm looking at his Wikipedia, he was born in 1997. So it's very much like he's looking at the retro music to him.
Yes, yeah. It's no, funny. This music is retro to him. And
this is the Chappell Roan thing, too. Like, her music feels very retro and very 80s inspired.
Yeah, no, yeah. It feels kind of Madonna. It feels kind of Kate Bush. Mm-hmm. This guy is also, like, a fantastic guitarist and, like, really, really intriguing producer. If you're interested in anything like this, go check out McGee. Go check out Two Star and the Dream Police, and also check out this other album. I think it's called Absolutely by R&B artist Dijon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love Dijon. Yeah.
Mr. Michael Gordon, aka McGee, did a lot of production and a lot of guitar work on that album. So check that out. I think it's worth it.
Very cool. Thank you. Well, you know, I have a whole new sound setup, Ben, so I'm looking for things to test it with. And what I like when I get new audio gear, like new speakers and whatever, is just like crank the stuff I know, but also find new things. So I'm going to check this out. I was recently doing like FKA Twigs' most recent stuff. She has a new music video that is like...
If we're talking about vocal layering, yes. Twigs does Twigs. Fantastic vocal layering. Twigs. And go and listen to Rockman by McGee. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard vocal harmonies like that, honestly, since like Genesis or The Police. It's really impressive.
Awesome. Some things I want to shout out. I re-reviewed Gladiator over at the Filmcast. And I just want to say that movie still rips. That movie, it feels really weird to watch Gladiator like 24 years after it came out and to remember like what a cultural phenomenon it was. The score, everything, Russell Crowe in it. It's not a perfect movie. I think there's a lot of like silly bits, but it is so like memorably written. There's some great quotes, just like great ripping revenge story. We're gearing up to review Gladiator 2, which I have not seen yet. I hope it's good. But recent Ridley Scott movies have made me very worried about like what he can do now. But yeah, Gladiator's still good, guys. Gladiator still rips. That Hans Zimmer score. I actually need to re-watch the opening scene with the new receiver. Noted. Mental thing I need to do now. Because the Gladiator, the opening fight, was like for the longest time, if you had a home theater, that was your like demo. That was like, what does that fight sound like? As you get new speakers or whatever. So Gladiator still rips. Also want to quickly shout out Dune Prophecy, which just kicked off on HBO Max. This is the prequel series. It's set 10,000 years before the whole story of Paul Atreides and everything. It's about the sort of formation of the Bene Gesserit and the beginning of the plan to make like an ultimate Dune leader or something. It suffers from prequelitis because you know kind of where this will all lead. But I'd say it's vaguely watchable. And talking about like how we're worried about AI and everything, minor spoiler, but we do get a glimpse of the AI war that they often talk about and why they don't use thinking machines in the Dune universe. In the very first 5 minutes, it's an opening that feels like Terminator 2 almost. And even that scene feels like a Terminator thing. But it really brought me back into this world. I love the lead actors. Emily Watson and Olivia Williams are starring in this. Mark Strong is the Emperor this time around. It's interesting. Kind of just like existing in the Dune world and seeing this production, like it looks like the movies. It doesn't feel like a cheap TV show. But I don't know where this is going to lead. I don't know if this season will be worth watching overall, but I dig the vibes and I dig like just seeing more of this universe. If you like Dune, you want to see more Dune, watch at least the first episode or at least the first couple minutes of Dune Prophecy.
All right, that's it for us. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
Devendra on Blue Sky and Mastodon and wherever. And I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
I have a shiny new Blue Sky account that Devendra doesn't follow. You can find me at heybellman.bluesky.social. Send us an email at podcast.engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes, and you can subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. Pocket Casts, Overcast, is that still a thing? And Spotify.